from today on, we're going to look at entering the mandala from the point of view of the threefold path, or the other way around, looking at the threefold path in terms of the mandala, of being in the mandala. Just one more general thing about the way of looking at the spiritual life in terms of a mandala. It came up in our group yesterday. In a sense, it's not really another new teaching what we're doing here. It's more sort of method, or not a method, rather a perspective on our lives and our spiritual lives, which organizes it. Yeah. So we have all these practices and do all these things, but what can often happen is, we have all these stuff, they're almost sort of disconnected with each other, and we don't really understand what is important, what is less important. And seeing it from the point of view of the mandala, that gives order to that sort of even our Buddhist chaos, let alone our worldly one. So I realized in preparing the talk, there's not much new I'm going to say in it. It's just sort of more putting into the perspective of the mandala. There's something else on the mandala. So at the center of the mandala, ideally, there's the Buddha or the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. In a sense, what we try to do is, there's something else there which has to sort of be pushed aside, and that is ourselves. So actually, to a large extent, at the center of our mandala is ourselves. And everything circles around that. My objective needs, read whims and fancies, sort of my ideas are right, other people are wrong, my needs are important, other people's are less important. So what we try to do, and we can even do that, in a sense, we can do that with the Dharma as well. So what can easily happen, rather than putting the Buddha into the center of our mandala, is ourselves and our own idea about the Buddha. And the same is for the Dharma and the Sangha. So just sort of more general point about the mandala. So our practice consists in a way in moving ourselves away from the center of our own lives. And putting the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha at the center of our own lives. Maybe that's a different way of looking at non-self. I haven't thought about it deeper. But, maybe it's a different way of looking at oneself, of moving to the side and letting the Buddha be there. Okay, so we come to the... as Padmavajra yesterday said, at the center of the mandala, ideally, there's the three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And in a sense, right next to it, if you do it visually, are the precepts. And this is something which sort of is, in some ways, very obvious for us. We all learned it on our sort of when the first time we recited the refuges and precepts, that should have been there. But I think what can easily happen is we forget that. We forget the centrality of the precepts, the centrality of ethics. It took me a long time, I think 1 or 2 years ago, I suddenly realized that we recite the refuges and precepts together. I mean, I sort of knew it, but sort of it hasn't really sunk in what that actually means. It means our practice is the precepts. And it would be interesting just to ask ourselves, if we talk about our practice, is the first thing that comes to our mind our practice of the precepts? I suspect in most cases not. It's probably something like meditation or insight. But actually our practice is precepts. That is practice. Bhante talks about that in the Ten Pillars of Buddhism, where he talks about the centrality of refuges and precepts, where he uses the image of going for refuge being the lifeblood of a Buddhist. So that what makes us Buddhist, what keeps us alive as Buddhists, is the going for refuge. And practicing the precepts is a circulation of that lifeblood. So it's not just they're closely connected, they're almost the same thing. They're very close. Well, to say they're close is not enough. So if blood stops to circulate, it's not blood anymore. If the precepts aren't practiced, it's not going for refuge anymore. So they are, as I said, closely connected, even closer than closely connected. There's also quite an interesting connection, I find. What the precepts do, what ethics does, it looks at sort of the immediate moment-by-moment practice of our lives. And I think one thing we also need to do when we practice, well, we have to do that. It's what we can often do. We can sort of, on the one hand, dwell in fundamental, abstract, universal teachings. Yeah? Like we all go for refuge to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. We think the Buddha is great. Dharma is important. Yes, the Sangha is important. But it can be quite general. The way that is lived out moment by moment is by practicing the precepts. So it makes the connection between what we do moment by moment and our general aim in life, our general values in life. Because I think often what we can do, we can be genuinely inspired by our values in life, but not moment by moment. Yeah? So we make exceptions all the time, basically. I want to come back, in a sense, I want to come back to something Padmavacha said yesterday. He mentioned the six garavas, the six objects of reverence. And apart from the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, or the teacher, the Dharma and the Sangha, there's training, the sikha. So there's reverence for the training. Actually, it's interesting that two of those six reverences are ethical. The sikha, training, which is the precepts, because it's actually in the words of the precepts. Yeah, let's notice sikha patang samadhyami. Yeah. So our training is the precepts. So that's one of the six objects of reverence, is the practice of the precepts. And the idea of our training, the precepts, ethics, being object of reverence, implies a sort of sense of mystery and wonder. A sense that we don't really understand what they are. Just as we don't really understand the Buddha, and we don't really understand what the Dharma is, and we don't really understand what Sangha can be. In the same way, I think we don't really understand what ethics can be. Yeah? We haven't really fathomed the depth of ethics. So having one's training, training is a term which sounds very down to earth. Yeah, so down to earth we do, which can make it a bit sort of dry. Yeah? But I think it's quite important having a sense of even our day-to-day, moment-by-moment training of the precepts even is unfathomable. Yeah. It's possible to go into depth with our understanding of the precepts, our practice of the precepts, which we haven't even thought about yet. Yeah. So even our potential practice of the precepts is mysterious. I would even say individually, I don't think there's any ethical area which we have fully grasped. Whether it's the five precepts or the ten. Yeah. With any of them, we haven't fully grasped them. So if any ethical issue comes up and your first response is, I've got that sorted, it's not a problem for me, I'm not sure about that. Not to say I don't really believe it. So that's sort of ethics as an object of reverence, or training of the precepts as an object of reverence. The other one was Appamada, the fifth of the six garavas, which is, the translation is alertness, non-heedlessness. Again, it's ethical awareness. Yeah, so the fifth of the six garavas is ethical. There is an ethical connotation to it. It's sort of awareness with regard to ethics. Yeah, and as Padmavacha yesterday said, these were the last words of the Buddha, Appamadena Sampadeta. So he didn't say strive with mindfulness. In mindfulness in terms of knowing what my right foot is doing. It's more sort of striving with ethical alertness. Okay, so now I want to look at, I talked about the fact that the refuges and precepts are closely connected. I'm going to look at that more in sort of detail, how that works with the individual refuges. Because it may bring different ways of looking at ethics. So ethics and the Buddha, there's the connection, well, apart from the fact the Buddha taught it, so there's a connection with the Buddha there. Also, practicing the precepts is the natural way an enlightened being lives his life. In a sense, the enlightened one doesn't practice the precepts anymore. It's just his natural way of being. There's a list of things an arahant, enlightenment, can't do. Killing, stealing, and lying. He's also not interested in sex, apparently. In the last discrete sheet, it got some reaction in my study group, interestingly enough. Well, shows what's important to us. But this, so ethics is a natural being, way of the being of an enlightened one, of the Buddha. So if we practice the precepts, for us it's not natural, we have to practice it. In a sense, we align ourselves to the behavior of an enlightened one. Yeah. So we act like an enlightened one when we try to practice the precepts. There's also a sense of pride and self-respect in that. This comes out strongly in certainly in the Bodhicharyavatara, probably in early Buddhism as well, is that, it comes out in the Pali Canon, it's mentioned, is that Buddha calls his disciples, "You are my sons, born of my mouth." And in the Bodhicharyavatara, it says after the rising of the Bodhicitta, after he made a commitment, "I am now a son of the Buddha." So there's something, if we have the Buddha at the center of our lives, we belong to that family. Yeah. And as the text continues, "And I am now a son of the Buddha, and now I must live up to my birth, and by my actions must place no stain upon that spotless family." So there's another strong connection with the Buddha and ethics. Yeah. In deciding to go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, we now belong to the family of the Buddhas. And we must act accordingly. We want to act accordingly. I think it's a strong sense of self. For me, it's connected with a strong sense of self-respect. Yeah? It's almost that if I see myself as a disciple of the Buddha, there's certain actions I should be too good to do. Instead of they should be beneath me, really. Yeah? It's almost embarrassing to do certain stupid, selfish actions if at the same time I see myself as a disciple of the Buddha. Yeah? Sort of more embarrassing, sort of. Yeah? Yeah, so I see a strong connection there with sort of a healthy pride and a healthy self-respect. So that's ethics and the Buddha. Something about the Dharma. I'm not sure if I'm pushing the analogy now, but again, Padmavacha mentioned the image or the concept that the Buddha is a sort of the spiritual king of the realm. Yeah? And if you have a king, you have laws. Maybe I'm pushing the analogy now a bit. Yeah? But in a sense, the Dharma is the laws of the land. If the Buddha is the king, the Dharma are the laws. And specifically, the precepts. And very specifically, the law of karma. Yeah? So if we take on the Dharma as a refuge, probably the most important teaching for us is the teaching on karma. Maybe practically speaking, that's far more important than teachings like impermanence and non-self. Maybe, as far as our spiritual life is concerned, really understanding the law of karma is probably far more important than understanding oneself. And in going for refuge to the Dharma, in going for refuge, we place our lives on karma. Which means we accept the law of karma, which basically means actions have consequences. Sounds quite easy. Actions have consequences. So every willed action has results for myself and the surroundings. And it's those actions which I want to base my life on. If we don't have karma as the center of our mandala, it's probably more the question of pleasure. Yeah. So if we don't have the law of karma at the center of our practice, we don't take on the law of karma, we take on the law of pleasure and comfort and selfishness. Yeah. So if we look at what am I doing with my life, the Buddhist response is look at your actions. Look at what you're doing. Yeah. Not do I get my needs fulfilled? Or do I get enough pleasure in life? Yeah. It's more sort of look at one's action. I will come back to that a few times in this talk, I think. Yeah, so in a sense, going for refuge to the Dharma means living in constant awareness of karma, of the fact actions have consequences, and the fact we shape our lives by our actions. It means taking responsibility. Yeah, I come back to this other point here. Sangha and ethics. There's two ways, a number of ways of looking at that. One is, realistically speaking, we can't do that alone. As I said, our understanding of the precept is probably superficial. And if we want to deepen our understanding of the precept and our practice of the precepts, we do need other people who have the same values. In a sense, we need someone to explore ethics with. Yeah, we need other people with whom we can explore ethics. That can mean talking about problems, ethical areas, opening up about them. It also means confessing. Yeah, so if we are, I'll come to confession soon, but, well, often, if we are honest, if we're really aware, we notice that we fall short in terms of our practice of the precepts. So the reply to that is to confess. And we need someone to confess to. Yeah? So part of the importance of Sangha is there are people around with who have the same values as we have and to whom we can confess. One question is, well, we all are in contact with the Sangha, the centers of going for refuge groups, ordinals. Are we making enough use of that? Do we relate to each other in the Sangha enough on the basis of ethics? But I think I want to turn it around. So far, I have said that Sangha is important for the practice of ethics. I think really it's the other way around. It's ethics which supports Sangha. Yeah, it's sort of ethical honesty which deepens our friendships, which gives trust. I think I want to get away from the idea that Sangha is good for something else. Yeah. Sangha is not good for our practice. Our practice should be good for Sangha. Yeah. Sangha is more important than our own practice. Our own practice should support the Sangha, not the other way around. Something to discuss. Yeah, you could say without other people, we have only a very superficial idea of ethics. And without ethics, we have a very superficial idea of Sangha. And there's something else with Sangha and the precepts. Again, it's one of those very obvious things we can easily be overlooked because they're so obvious. It's the way the order works. Well, you all want to join the order. And to do that, you need someone to ordain you. And this person is called a preceptor. Precept is the operative word here. The person who sort of witnesses your going for refuge witnesses not only one's effective going for refuge, but also one's effective practice of the precepts. Instead of, it's so obvious that it just gets overlooked. Yeah. So in a way, the role of the preceptor is to, in a sense, to be in dialogue with you about your practice of the precepts. Well, it's one of the roles of the preceptor. I think sort of individually and probably collectively, I wonder whether it has sunk in sufficiently. Yeah. If you discuss the role of a preceptor, in a sense, it's sort of, yeah, he witnesses your going, effective going for refuge and your practice of the precepts. So, in a sense, ethics, the practice of ethics should be a big part of one's communication with one's preceptor. Because that's what the ordination is based on. I had a thought, I don't know if it makes any sense. Maybe you shouldn't bother too much about mentoring in meditation. Maybe you should bother more about mentoring in ethics. Yeah. Well, we're more concerned about getting it right with meditation and having someone to tell us the details about it. Maybe we should be more concerned in having someone who can help us sorting out the details of ethics. So this is of more general, more way in which the precepts are connected with refuges, more individually. So the Buddha, in a way, practicing what for us is practicing the precepts is for a Buddha the natural expression of his being. Just the way he is. In a way, that's why the enlightened one is beyond good and evil. It doesn't mean he can do what he does, do what he wants. Yeah? But that means being ethical. With the Dharma, well, the most important teaching is the law of karma. which finds an immediate expression in ethics. And with the Sangha, well, we need people to do practice ethics with. We need to set up the conditions to do that. And also, sincere practice of ethics deepens Sangha, because it gives, it provides trust. I want to talk a few other areas connected with ethics, not in a particular order. Let's see where that goes. I mentioned before confession. So if we practice the precepts, if we practice anything, we fail. I think we have to just sort of accept, if you have any ideal, anything sort of beyond us, we can't help noticing that we fall short of that. Yeah. It's almost of the nature of the spiritual life. Yeah. So training oneself in ethics is not only about knowing what's good and not good to do. It's not only knowing what's right and what's not right. It also includes the ability to regret. You've got these two positive mental events, mental activities rather, two positive mental activities, Hiri and Ottapa. Not quite sure what the standard translation for them is. Hiri is sort of, I call it regret. It's a sense of feeling uneasy with oneself when you've done something which was wrong. Yeah. So often is an understatement, very often, we fall short of our ideals. Yeah. And it's perfectly healthy to feel bad about yourself then. I think it's a good sign. If you're incapable of feeling sort of any regret or feeling bad about yourself, it's sort of, it's almost hopeless, spiritually speaking, because of, you won't change. Yeah? I know feeling bad about yourself is wrong, I know all that, but you have to grow up as well. So when we act in a way which sort of goes against our own ideals, we feel bad about it. I think it's perfectly natural to do that. And it's not feeling bad in the sense of I'm a complete failure and a bad person. It's more, it's very specific. The feeling of regret in this healthy sense, in a skillful sense, it's about a very specific action. Yeah. So when you've done something which afterwards you know was wrong, and you really know it wasn't really necessary to do that. I mean, sometimes it's sort of, you could have done better, basically. It happens often. Yeah. So if you do something sort of selfish, lazy, and you thought, with a bit of honesty, you know you could have done better. The feeling which then comes is regret. You will regret it. And that's a positive mental event, a skillful mental state. Regret is a skillful mental state. Yeah, so part of training in ethics is almost of the ability to feel regret, which is different from neurotic guilt. I think neurotic guilt is more about you're just a bad person, generally speaking. If you don't look at the details of that, why you're a bad person, you're just a bad person. Whereas proper regret is more, you look at the details of your action and you sort of regret it. So that's Hiri. Just a sort of, I think another way of calling it is ethical awareness. I think for me it's also connected with a sense of self-respect. Some translators call it self-respect. Yeah. So out of one's respect for oneself, one sort of feels bad if you've done something which sort of goes below that. Yeah. So the sense of regret is connected with the sense of self-respect. A completely different way of looking at regret, which I got from a German author, Peter Beery. He wrote a book on free will and choice. Quite an interesting book. It's not translated into English, unfortunately. It's a very good book. And he has a bit on regret, and he called regret sadness. Our regret is a sense of sadness that we've lost something, we've lost ourselves for a period of time when we weren't the person we like to be. Yeah. So we all have this image of ourselves as a fairly sorted out, nice person. So we think of ourselves as fairly mature, fairly selfless, good, and so forth. Yeah? Some image we have of ourselves. That's what we are. But then we have to address the fact there was a period in our life when we haven't lived up to that. In a sense, we haven't existed as that person. And that's a loss. And that loss will never come back. Yeah? So the period of our life which is wasted, which will never come back. It's a bit dramatic, but I think it's an interesting way of looking at regret. It's a loss of having, it's a sadness of having lost a part of one's life. Yeah? So it's a slightly different way of looking at regret, which I quite like. So that's regret. The other one is this hiri, otapa. It's sort of more respect for the wise. The sangha comes back in here. We are social beings, and we don't like to be unpopular. This is almost normal human behavior. And in a sense, what Buddhism does, we make use of that. Yeah. So when it comes to ethical questions, or we think about what to do, we can just ask ourselves, would I do that if my friends in the Sangha were in the same room? Yeah. If not, interesting. Yeah. So matters of unethical. It's sort of, I think we have the tendency to hide our unethical deeds. Yeah, sort of, yeah. And we try to get by with sort of nobody noticing it. And this feeling of otapa, of respect for the wise, it sort of, it takes into account sangha again. Yeah. Would I do that if my friends knew about it? Now the thing is, they will know about it because they're going to confess at some point. Hopefully. Yeah. So the feeling of sort of something which sort of prevents us from getting into sort of unethical areas is respect for others. People, it's people we respect. Yeah. In a sense, sort of often just self-respect isn't enough to motivate us to act ethically. Okay? Because we're the only ones who notice. It's often sort of what other people whom we respect may make of that, which motivate us stronger. And just to say, this respect for the wise is not fear of punishment or authority. Or not authority in a negative sense. Not so that we, they won't, our friends won't punish us. Yeah, probably make jokes about it. So that they punish us. Most of we feel uneasy because in a sense we let them down. So that's the area of failing. Another area of ethics is selfish ethics, what I call selfish ethics. I said at the beginning that ideally we have the Buddha Dhamma Sangha at the center of our mandala. Often it's actually ourselves, yeah, in our own version, and you know, some sort of self-obsession. And it's even possible to do that with the practice of the precepts. That we can be more interested, well, in a sense, what ethics is about, it's quite simple really, the basis of ethics is you are aware that other people are living beings. In a sense, that's all there is to ethics. It's just an awareness that other people are living beings who don't want to suffer pain. Yeah? I want to be happy, others want to be happy, why am I more important? I mean, that's all there is to ethics. That's all there is to the metta-bhavana, really. Yeah? You can sort of take it down to that level. But our tendency is to sort of think of ourselves as more important. And even the danger is that we think of our own practice of ethics as more important than other people. You have almost sort of parodies of that in sort of Buddhist Mahayana literature, or Buddhist Mahayana propaganda literature in a way. That you have sort of selfish practitioner, the selfish arahant, who's only concerned about the arahant in the sort of propaganda sense, not the real arahant, yeah? Who acts only for his own purity, but forgets about other people. And that's a human tendency to do that. Yeah, that we can be so concerned about our own ethical and spiritual purity that we can't forget about other people. But really, ethics is about the effect we have on others. Yeah. To act ethically means you try to be aware as much as possible on the effect we have on other people. I think there's ways of avoiding that. Yeah, it's almost a kind of a bit of a selfish attitude to ethics. You've got this thing, trying to be honest all the time, no matter what the consequences are. You're just honest. Yeah? Which probably is probably a euphemism for unfriendly. I just practice honesty, so I say everybody what I think, no matter how they feel about it. your own ethics is sort of pure, but you don't really care about the effect you have. Yeah. So there are sort of ways of being ethical which doesn't take into account the actual needs of the other person. Which isn't really being ethical. So it's sort of stating the obvious, really, but big part or main part of our practice of precept and ethics is being aware of the effect we have on others and being aware of the fact they are a living being, rather than just following rules which make me feel good about myself. So that's the area of self, what's called selfish ethics. Yeah. Then something I forgot to mention earlier, just to come back to that. With the precepts, well, we have the negative precepts and the positive precepts, if you all know. And I think Bunty said somewhere, I don't know where, our working ground is the positive precepts. I mean, if you just fulfill the negative precepts, I avoid harming people, I think a lot would be gained already. If you just avoid making more trouble in the world, I mean, a lot would be gained, yeah? But in a sense, it's not enough. Yeah. So the precepts are practicing of positive qualities. Yeah. So it comes to the second precept. It's not only avoiding taking the not given, which can be in all sorts of areas, but it's actually practicing generosity, and that's endless. Yeah, and that's for all the precepts. So there are... Our practice of ethics should be more something positive, something we do, rather than something we just avoid. It's not just avoiding getting into trouble or getting other people into trouble. It's actually sort of developing positive actions. And in this way, we actually reorganize our mandala. Yeah, this is also the way we organize our mandala around, is by the positive precepts. Okay, so it's a positive precept. Sort of at the end come to another area of ethics. It sort of moves into the area of the next two talks. So I hope I won't take any topics away from myself tomorrow and Paramavacha the day after. Again, it's one of those things which seem obvious but we forget it. We act with body, speech and mind. Body acting with body and speech is fairly obvious. I mean, it's still not obvious enough, but it's not fairly clear. Yeah. So. But mental activity have ethical value. What we do with our mind counts. And that requires a sort of almost fine-tuning of awareness of one's mind. Because there are things in the mind which happen. And we can't do anything about them. And then there's things in the mind which we do. And part of our a big part of our training is to learn to distinguish between them. Because we probably get it wrong, we are getting it wrong often. On the one hand, we can feel almost sort of a sense of shame and regret about things happening in our mind which are just sort of just a result. They just don't happen to us. Yeah. We can feel guilty about liking certain things or disliking certain things. That's sort of innocent. Yeah. I think I remember it was a 10 Pillars retreat, somebody said something they feel ashamed about, and it's about liking certain TV series, which is on the whole, well, probably exceptions, on the whole ethically innocent. I think it was Star Trek, nothing wrong with that. Don't need to be ashamed of that, yeah? I suppose. But often we can feel sort of ashamed of something which is just sort of ethically irrelevant. Matters of taste, often. But on the other hand, we can feel sort of unashamed about things we actually do in our mind. We think they don't have consequences. So part of training in ethics, or part of training in the Dharma, is to learn to distinguish that. So learn to distinguish between things which happen, and which just sort of, just happen in the mind, and things we actually do, mental activity. And it's mental activity which counts. I mean, this is where sort of the Dhamma begins. There's the first two verses of the Dhammapada. Yeah. The experience are preceded by mind, led by mind, and so on. Yeah. So So it's our mental activity, which is the beginning of everything. It's our calm or volitional mental activity, which in its, after a while comes out in action and speech. Yeah. I mean, we hardly ever speak unkindly without having had some unkind thoughts beforehand. Yeah. And it's not only the way we act, it also brings out the way we see the world. Yeah, so our mental activity sets up mental habits which determine the world we live in, the way we see the world. So if you nurture your paranoia, you're going to live in a world surrounded by enemies. If you nurture your anxiety, you live in a frightening world. So we have to look at what we do in our mind, because that counts. Yeah, it's ethically relevant. So we have in the 10 precepts, three mind precepts, craving, hatred, and wrong views. So with craving and hatred as mind precepts, we want to sort of look at what are we doing with our minds, sort of, if we've got nothing better to do, so, you know, so slightly bored, state traveling or whatever, yeah? So fantasies about what you'd rather do or have, or sort of, yeah, nurturing, we can sort of nurture our dissatisfaction. Yeah? We can nurture our craving, nurture our dissatisfaction. Sort of detailed plannings of the next computer you're going to buy. Yours hasn't broken down yet, but you already think which one you're going to buy. That's actually, when, strictly speaking, it's breaking the precept of craving, strictly speaking. And then you act on it by sort of checking on the internet or the computer if there are stuff. You don't actually need one, but you do it anyway. So that would be a breaking the precept, strictly speaking. Aversion, so it's sort of nurturing one's dissatisfaction, nurturing one's craving, fantasizing about what you want to do, what you want to have, and so on. Yeah. And actively fantasizing, not just sort of, it's not about the thought popping up, but then nurturing that thought, feeding that thought. Yeah. That's ethically relevant. Aversion is another one. Yeah, so you can nurture our aversion. For example, cultivating a grudge. I mean, just sort of not liking somebody, in a sense, it's harmless. Finding some people pleasant, some people unpleasant. That's just life. Yeah. But then you nurture that, and that's karmically relevant. Yeah. Like, examples would be to keep somebody you're in conflict with, keep mentioning mentally all their bad qualities. Yeah. Or the other one, it's very popular, I'm good at it, you go through these sort of mental discussions with the person. You've got a conflict with somebody, and actually you just thought you're meditating, but what you're actually doing, you rehearse the next argument. And in that argument you're rehearsing, you're actually winning. And your opponent is reduced to a wreck, and he has to grudgingly admit your greatness and cleverness. If you do that, it's a breaking of the precept of aversion. Probably come craving in there as well, you're wanting praise. But this sort of, these mental activities do actually matter. They have a result. They're not just innocent. A very interesting one is the ethical nature of views, because the 10th precept is about wrong view as an ethical problem. Just one misunderstanding which comes up often. The wording of the precept, it's Michadasana, not avidya. What that means is you see the ethical problem of wrong views, not the ethical problem of basic ignorance. Yeah. I think it would be pointless to keep confessing that you're not enlightened. I mean, strictly speaking, ignorance is karmically active, but practically speaking, it would be a bit pointless to go around confessing that you're not enlightened all the time. It becomes a bit meaningless. But what we can look at is our views, and views are usually the rationalizations and expressions of craving and hatred, of our feelings. So the mechanism is, at the bottom of our being is ignorance, the basic not knowing, not understanding, not seeing actually, it's not absence of knowing, it's not seeing, blindness. That expresses itself in craving and aversion. But we must find good reasons for our craving and aversion. So we come up with ideas and views about them, have opinions. Yeah, this is sort of the way it works. So part of our practice of ethics is looking at the views we have. Just to mention a few examples how to do that. One is a positive way of doing it. So we have the positive precept as well. It's not just avoiding wrong view, but practicing right view. Something I've been sort of trying to do myself is sort of more being more aware of unconscious wrong views I have. It's usually around the area of materialism. Yeah. The belief that matter is real, mind is less real. It's probably most of us scientifically influenced people think. Yeah. And trying to work consciously on where I catch myself thinking that, and then sort of trying to not do it. Yeah. So see the importance of mind. But there's also looking at wrong views in a sense of, I think often our wrong views are cheap excuses. I think it's basically another word of putting it. Yeah. Or actively not wanting to see, like actively not accepting impermanence. So if something is impermanent, breaks, or sort of ends, whenever you think, why does this happen to me? This should not have happened to me. Strictly speaking, there's a wrong view behind that. Why shouldn't it happen to you? Yeah? Things are impermanent and break. Yeah? Things end. But sort of telling yourself, why me? This is unfair. There's something of the wrong view in there. Maybe the most important one, where we fool ourselves, where we break the precept, is actually in the area of the law of karma again. Yeah, actions have consequences. We're probably endlessly creative when it comes to finding excuses for doing what we want to do. Yeah. I mean, it must be astonishing the sort of amount of creativity and cleverness which goes into the area of finding excuses. Like, I should not force myself to do things, is a good one, or I should only meditate if I feel like it. But it's sort of a denying of the law of karma. Because you base your actions on feeling, not on value. Yeah. The other one, which I think if you just sort of formulate it, absurdity becomes clear, but this is something I do, is the view that I do believe actions have consequences. I'm convinced of actions have consequences, but not the one thing I'm about to do now. Well, this one doesn't matter. I think that's a basic wrong view. I think it's breaking. Whenever you tell yourself that, this, whenever you say, well, of course it's wrong, I know I shouldn't do it, but this one doesn't matter. Yeah. You basically have this one unique exception in the universe. Yeah. Everything in the humans do, every action has consequences, every willed action has consequences, but not the one I happen to want to do now. Yeah, this is sort of strange gap in the hole in the universe in which the law of karma doesn't sort of function. So just to formulate one's views shows sort of the absurdity of them often. Yeah. Okay, so these were my thoughts on ethics. Precept is the first part of the threefold path in terms of the mandala. So the precepts are absolutely central. They're not just close to the refuges, they are going for refuge in a way. I mean, they're sort of very close. As Bhante said, there's a circulation of the blood, and the blood is the going for refuge. And we have to look at all the implications of that in our own lives, and the depth of it, the breadth of it, what it means to our lives. And probably practically speaking for most of us, that means setting up the conditions, i.e. organizing our personal life, organizing our mandala in such a way that we can really practice the precepts.